I leave, and don't even think about setting foot outside the Jesuit Curia until I get there. Gabriel killed the connection. Tell me something, asked Lavon. What's it like to be you?
Exhausting.
Why don't you sleep for a couple of hours while we pack up? I'd love to, but I have one more question I'd like to ask our newest asset.
What's that?
Gabriel told him. That's two questions, said Lavon. Smiling, Gabriel carried Esterman's phone downstairs. The German was drinking coffee at the interrogation table, watched over by Mikhail and Oded. He was unshaven, and his right cheek was bruised. With a razor and a bit of makeup, he would be as good as new. Warily, he watched as Gabriel sat down in the chair opposite.
What is it now?
We're going to clean you up. Then we're going to take a drive.
Where?
Gabriel stared at Esterman blankly. There's no way you'll get past the guards at the checkpoint.
I won't have to. You'll do it for me.
It won't work.
For your sake, it better.
But before we leave, I'd like you to answer one more question. Gabriel placed Esterman's phone on the table. Why did you go to Bonn after you spoke to Stephanie Hoffmann? And why did you switch off your phone for 2 hours and 57 minutes?
I didn't go to Bonn.
Your phone says you did. Gabriel tapped the screen. It says you left Café du Gotard at 2:34 p.m. and that you reached the outskirts of Bonn around 7:15, which is rather good time, I must say. At that point, you switched off your phone.
I want to know why.
I told you, I didn't go to Bonn.
Where did you go?
The German hesitated.
I was in Grossau. It's a little farming village a few miles to the west.
What's in Grossau?
A cottage in the woods.
Who lives there?
A man named Hamid Fauzi.
Who is he?
He's a creation of my cyber unit.
Is he the reason bombs are going off in Germany?
No, said Esterman. I am.
Chapter 43. Cologne, Germany. Gerhard Schmidt was not known for working long hours. Typically, he arrived at BFV headquarters in Cologne with a minute or two to spare before the 10 a.m. senior staff meeting, and barring some emergency, he was in the back seat of his official limousine no later than 5. Most nights, he stopped at one of the city's better watering holes for a drink. But only one. Everything in moderation. That was Schmidt's personal maxim. It would be chiseled on his tombstone. The bombings in Berlin and Hamburg had proven detrimental to Schmidt's salubrious daily schedule. That morning, he was at his desk at the ungodly hour of 8 o'clock, a time when ordinarily he would still be in bed with coffee and the papers. Consequently, when his secure phone pulsed with an incoming call from Tel Aviv at 8:15, he was there to answer it. He'd been expecting to hear the voice of Gabriel Alon, the legendary director general of the Israeli Secret Intelligence Service. Instead, it was Uzi Navot, Alon's deputy, who bade Schmidt a pleasant morning in perfect German. Schmidt had a grudging respect for Alon, but Navot he loathed. For many years, the Israeli had worked undercover in Europe, running networks and recruiting agents, including 3 who worked for the BFV. Within a few seconds, however, Schmidt was deeply remorseful he had ever uttered an unkind word. Indeed, that he had ever entertained a slanderous thought about the man at the other end of the secure line. It seemed the Israelis, as was often the case, had tapped into a vein of magic intelligence, this time regarding the new cell wreaking havoc in Germany. Navot was predictably evasive about how he had acquired this intelligence. It was a mosaic, he claimed, a blend of human sources and electronic intercepts. Lives were at stake. The clock was ticking. Whatever the source of the information, it was highly specific. It concerned a property in Grossau, a tiny farming hamlet located on the edge of the dense German forest known as the Hütgenwald. The property was owned by something called OSH Holdings, a Hamburg-based concern. There were 2 structures, a traditional German farmhouse and an outbuilding fashioned of corrugated metal. The farmhouse was largely unfurnished. In the outbuilding, however, was a 10-year-old Mitsubishi light-duty cargo truck loaded with 2 dozen drums of ammonium nitrate fertilizer, nitromethane, and Tovex, the makings of an ANNM bomb. The truck was registered to a Hamid Fauzi, a refugee
originally from Damascus, who had settled in Frankfurt after Syria erupted into civil war. Or so claimed his social media pages, which are updated frequently. An engineer by training, Fauzi worked as an IT specialist for a German consulting firm, which was also owned by OSH Holdings. His wife, Asma, wore a full-face veil whenever she left their apartment. They had two children, a daughter named Salma and a boy named Mohammed. According to Navot's intelligence, a single operative was scheduled to arrive at the property that morning at 10 o'clock. He could not say whether it would be Hamid Fauzi. He was quite certain, however, about the target, the immensely popular Cologne Christmas market now underway at the historic cathedral. Gerhard Schmidt had a long list of questions he wanted to ask Navot, but there wasn't time for anything more than an expression of profound gratitude. After hanging up, he immediately rang the interior minister, who in turn rang the chancellor along with Schmidt's counterpart at the Bundespolizei. The first officers arrived at the farmhouse at 8:30. A few minutes after 9, they were joined by four teams from GSG-9, Germany's elite tactical and counterterrorism unit. The officers made no attempt to enter the outbuilding, which was sealed with a heavy-duty lock. Instead, they concealed themselves in the surrounding woods and waited. At 10 a.m. sharp, a Volkswagen Passat estate car came bumping up the property's rutted drive. The man behind the wheel wore dark glasses and a woolen watch cap. His hands were gloved. He parked the Volkswagen outside the farmhouse and walked over to the outbuilding. The GSG-9 officers waited until he had opened the lock before emerging from the cover of the trees. Startled, the man reached inside his coat, apparently for a weapon, but wisely stopped when he saw the size of the force arrayed against him. This came as something of a surprise to the GSG-9 officers. They had been trained to expect jihadist terrorists to fight to the death. The officers were surprised a second time when, after handcuffing the man, they removed his dark glasses and woolen cap. Blonde and blue-eyed, he looked as though he had stepped off a Nazi propaganda poster. A rapid search found him to be in possession of a Glock 9mm pistol, three mobile phones, several thousand euros in cash, and an Austrian passport issued in the name Klaus Jäger. The Bundespolizei immediately contacted their brethren in Vienna, who knew Jäger well. He was a former Austrian police officer who had been relieved of duty for consorting with known neo-Nazis. It was at this point, at 10:30, that the story broke on the website of Die Welt, Germany's most respected newspaper. Based on an anonymous source, it stated that the Bundespolizei, acting on intelligence developed by BFV Chief Gerhard Schmidt, had arrested one of the men responsible for the bombings in Berlin and Hamburg. He was not a member of the Islamic State, as previously suspected, but a known neo-Nazi with ties to Axel Brunner and the far-right National Democratic Party. The attacks, reported Die Welt, were part of a cynical plot to drive up Brunner's support before the general election. Within minutes, Germany was thrown into political turmoil. Gerhard Schmidt, however, was suddenly the most popular man in the country. After hanging up with the chancellor, he rang Uzi Navot in Tel Aviv.
Mazel tov, Gerhard. I just saw the news.
I don't know how I'll ever repay you.
I'm sure you'll think of something.
There's only one problem, said Schmidt. I need to know the name of your source.
I'll never tell.
But if I were you, I'd take a hard look at OSH Holdings. I suspect it will lead you to an interesting place.
Where?
I wouldn't want to spoil the surprise. Did you and Alon know that Brunner and the far right were behind the bombings?
The far right? Navot sounded incredulous. Who could imagine such a thing?
Chapter 44. Bavaria, Germany. The source of Uzi Navot's remarkably accurate intelligence left Munich at 10:15 a.m. in the trunk of an Audi sedan. He remained there, bound and gagged, until the car reached the Bavarian village of Ilschenberg, where he was placed in the back seat next to Gabriel. Together they listened to the breaking news on ARD as the car began the ascent toward the Obersalzberg. Something tells me the Brunner boomlet just ended. Gabriel looked down at Esserman's phone, which was vibrating.
Speak of the devil.
That's the third time he's called.
He probably thinks I'm behind the story you planted in Die Welt.
Why would he think that? The bombing operation was highly compartmentalized. I was one of four people who knew the attacks were part of the Order's efforts to help him win the general election.
Talk about fake news, remarked Gabriel.
You're the one who engineered that story in Die Welt.
But everything I told them was true. In the front passenger seat, Elie Lavon laughed quietly before lighting a cigarette. Michael, who spoke only limited German, concentrated on his driving.
I really wish your associate would put out that cigarette, protested Esserman. And must the other one tap his fingers like that? It's very annoying.
Would you rather he tap on you instead?
He did quite enough of that last night.
Esserman worked his jaw from side to side.
Wolf is probably wondering why he hasn't heard from me.
He will in an hour or so. Something tells me he'll be relieved to see you.
I wouldn't be so sure about that.
How many guards will be at the checkpoint?
I told you that already.
Yes, I know, but tell me again.
Two, said Esserman. Both will be armed.
Remind me what happens when someone arrives.
The guards call Karl Weber, the chief of security. If the guests are expected, Weber allows the car to proceed. If they're not on the list, he checks in with Wolf. During the day, he's usually in his study. It's on the second floor of the chalet. The gospel is in the safe.
What's the combination?
87, 94, 98.
Not exactly hard to remember, is it?
Wolf requested it.
Sentimental reasons?
I wouldn't know. Herr Wolf is rather guarded when it comes to his personal life.
Esterman pointed toward the Alps.
Beautiful, aren't they?
There are no mountains like that in Israel.
That's true, admitted Gabriel.
But there are no people like you, either.
These days it is common practice for politicians of every ideological stripe to line their pockets by writing, or hiring someone to write, a book. Some are memoirs, others are clarion calls for action on issues near and dear to the politician's heart. Those copies that are not sold in bulk to supporters generally gather dust in warehouses or in the living rooms of journalists who are sent free copies by the publisher with the hope they might murmur something favorable on cable television or social media. The only winner in this charade is the politician, who typically pockets a large advance. He assures himself he deserves this money because of the enormous personal and financial sacrifice he has made by serving in government. In the case of Adolf Hitler, the book that made him wealthy was written a decade before his rise to power. He used a portion of the royalties to purchase Haus Wachenfeld, a modest holiday chalet in the mountains above Berchtesgaden. He commissioned an ambitious renovation of the dwelling in 1935, based on a rough sketch he made on a board borrowed from Albert Speer, his minister of armaments and war production. The result was the Berghof, a residence Speer described as most impractical for the reception of official visitors. As Hitler's power and paranoia increased, so did the Nazi footprint in the Obersalzberg. Perched atop the summit of the Kehlstein was the Eagle's Nest, a chalet used by senior party officials for meetings and social occasions, and within walking distance of the Berghof was the lavish tea house where Hitler whiled away afternoons with Eva Braun and Blondie, his beloved Alsatian. Several hundred RAF Lancaster bombers attacked the complex on April 25, 1945, inflicting heavy damage on the Berghof. The German government razed the tea house in the 1950s, but the Eagle's Nest remains a popular tourist attraction to this day, as does the village of Berchtesgaden. Andreas Esterman watched the snow falling on the tidy cobblestone streets.
It's the first storm of the season.
Climate change, replied Gabriel.
You don't really believe that nonsense, do you? It's a weather pattern, that's all.
Perhaps you should read something other than Der Stürmer now and again. Frowning, Esterman pointed out the postcard-perfect shops and cafes.
I think this is worth defending, don't you? Can you imagine what this town would look like with a minaret?
Or a synagogue?
Esterman was impervious to Gabriel's irony.
There are no Jews down here in the Obersalzberg, Alon.
Not anymore. Gabriel glanced over his shoulder. Directly behind them was the second Audi sedan. Yakov was driving, Yossi and Oded were in the back. Dina and Natalie were following in the Mercedes van. Gabriel dialed Natalie's number and told her to wait in the village.
Why can't we come with you?
Because things might get ugly.
Heaven knows we've never been in an ugly situation before.
You can file a complaint with personnel first thing tomorrow morning.
Gabriel killed the connection and instructed Mikhail to make a left turn at the end of the street. They sped along the banks of a granite-colored river, past small hotels and holiday cottages.
"We're less than 3 kilometers away," said Esterman.
"You do remember what will happen if you try to warn him.
You'll drop me down a deep hole."
Gabriel returned Esterman's phone. "Place the call in speaker mode." Esterman dialed. The phone rang, unanswered.
"He's not picking up."
"I have a suggestion."
"What's that?"
"Call him again." Chapter 45. Obersalzberg, Bavaria. Jonas Wolff was not a regular watcher of television. He regarded it as the true opiate of the masses and the source of the West's drift into hedonism, secularism, and moral relativism. On that morning, however, he had switched on the news in his comfortable study at 11:15, expecting to see the first reports of a major terrorist attack at Cologne's historic cathedral. Instead, he had learned that a truck bomb had been discovered at a remote compound in western Germany and that a former Austrian police officer with known ties to the extreme right had been taken into custody. Die Welt had linked the man to the bombings in Berlin and Hamburg and, more ominously, to Axel Brunner and the National Democratic Party. The attacks were purportedly part of a ruthless operation by Brunner and the far right to inflame the German electorate on the eve of the general elections. For now, at least, Wolff's name had not been mentioned in the coverage of the unfolding scandal. He doubted he would escape scrutiny for long. But how had the Bundespolizei learned of the compound in Grossau in the first place? And how had the reporter at Die Welt tied the bombings to Brunner's campaign so quickly? Wolff had but one suspect: Gabriel Allon. It was for that reason Wolff did not answer the first call he received from Andreas Esterman's iPhone. Now was not the time, he thought, to be talking to an accomplice who was calling from a cellular device. But when Esterman rang a second time, Wolff lifted the receiver hesitantly to his ear. Esterman's voice sounded an octave higher than normal. It is the voice, thought Wolff, of a man under obvious duress. It seemed a member of the order, who still worked for the BFV, had warned Esterman that he and Wolff were about to be arrested in connection with the bombings. Esterman was approaching the estate with several of his men. He wanted Wolff to be downstairs when he arrived. He had already instructed Platinum Flight Services, the fixed base operator at Salzburg Airport, to prepare one of the Gulfstreams for departure. A flight plan had been filed for Moscow. They would be airborne in less than an hour. Wolff was to bring his passport and as much cash as he could fit in a single briefcase. "And the gospel, Herr Wolff, whatever you do, don't leave it behind." The connection went dead. Wolff replaced the receiver and raised the volume of the television. A pack of reporters had cornered Brunner outside NDP headquarters in Berlin. His denials of involvement in the bombings had all the credibility of a murderer pleading his innocence while clutching a bloody knife in his hand. Wolff muted the volume. Then he reached for the phone and rang Otto Kessler, the general manager of Platinum Flight Support. After an exchange of pleasantries, Wolff asked if his plane was ready for departure.
"Which plane, Herr Wolff?"
"A man from my company was supposed to have called you." Kessler assured Wolff that no one had contacted him.
"You won't have a problem getting a departure slot, though. There's only one other private aircraft leaving this afternoon."
"And who might that be?" asked Wolff indifferently.
"Martin Landesmann."
"The Martin Landesmann?"
"It's his plane, but I'm not sure he'll be on board. It was empty when it arrived."
"Where is it going?"
"Tel Aviv, with a brief stop in Rome."
Gabriel Allon.
"And what time is Landesmann scheduled to depart?" added Wolff.
2 o'clock, weather permitting. The snow is forecast to worsen later this afternoon. We've been told to expect a complete ground stop sometime around 4.
Wolff rang off and immediately dialed Bishop Richter at the Orders Palazzo on the Janiculum Hill in Rome.
"I trust you've seen the news, Excellency."
"A troubling development," replied Richter, with his typical understatement.
"I'm afraid it's about to get worse."
"How much worse?"
"Germany is lost, at least for now. But the papacy is still within our reach. You must do everything in your power to keep our friend from the Society of Jesus away from the cardinals."
"He has 2 million reasons to keep his mouth shut."
2 million and one, said Wolff.
He hung up the phone and contemplated the river landscape hanging on the wall of his study. Painted by the Dutch old master Jan van Goyen, it had once belonged to a wealthy Viennese Jewish businessman named Samuel Feldman. Feldman had given it to Father Schiller, the founder of the order, in exchange for a set of false baptismal certificates for himself and his family. Regrettably, the baptismal certificates had not arrived in time to prevent the deportation of Feldman and his kin to the Lublin district of German-occupied Poland, where they were murdered. Concealed behind the landscape was Wolf's safe. He worked the tumbler, 87-94-98, and opened the heavy stainless steel door. Inside was 2 million euros in cash, 50 gold ingots, a 70-year-old Luger pistol, and the last remaining copy of the Gospel of Pilate. Wolf removed only the Gospel. He laid the book on his desk and opened it to the Roman prefect's account of the arrest and execution of a Galilean troublemaker called Jesus of Nazareth. Ignoring the advice of Bishop Richter, Wolf had read the passage the night Father Graf brought the book from Rome. Much to his shame, he had read it many times since. Fortunately, his would be the last eyes to ever see it. He carried the book to the window of his study. It overlooked the front of the chalet and the long road running the length of his private valley. In the distance, faintly visible through the falling snow, was the Untersberg, the mountain where Frederick Barbarossa had awaited his legendary call to rise and restore the glory of Germany. Wolf had heard the same call. The fatherland was lost, at least for now. But perhaps there was still a chance to save his church. The snow is forecast to worsen later this afternoon. We've been told to expect a complete ground stop sometime around 4. Wolf checked the time. Then he dialed Karl Weber, his security chief. As always, Weber answered on the first ring. Yes, Herr Wolf. Andreas Istermann will be arriving any minute. He's expecting me to meet him outside in the drive. But I'm afraid there's been a change in plan. Mikhail turned onto Wolf's private road and climbed steadily through a dense forest of spruce and birch. After a moment, the trees broke and a valley opened before them, ringed on three sides by towering mountains. Clouds draped the highest peaks. Esserman gave an involuntary start when Gabriel drew his Beretta. Don't worry, I'm not going to shoot you. Unless, of course, you give me the flimsiest of excuses. The guardhouse is on the left side of the road. Your point? I'm seated on the passenger side. If there's an exchange of gunfire, I might be caught in the crossfire, thus increasing my chances of survival. Behind them, Yakov flashed his headlamps. What's his problem? Asked Mikhail. I imagine he'd like to overtake us before we reach the checkpoint. What do you want me to do, boss? Can you shoot and drive at the same time? Is the Pope Catholic? There is no Pope right now, Mikhail. That's why we're about to have a conclave. The guardhouse appeared before them, veiled by snowfall. Two security men in black ski jackets stood in the middle of the road, each holding an HK MP5 submachine pistol. They didn't appear concerned by the two cars approaching at high speed, nor did they give any indication that they were planning to move out of the way. Shall I run them over? Asked Mikhail. Why not? Mikhail lowered the two windows on the passenger side of the car and put his foot to the floor. The two security men retreated to the shelter of the guardhouse. One waved cordially as the cars passed. It looks as though your ruse worked, Alon. They're supposed to stop every car. Mikhail raised the windows. To their left, across a snow-covered meadow, an Airbus executive helicopter stood on its pad with the sadness of an abandoned toy. Wolf's chalet appeared a moment later. A single figure stood in the drive. His black ski jacket was identical to the ones worn by the men at the checkpoint. His hands were empty. That's Weber, said Esterman. He's got a 9mm under his jacket. Is he right-handed or left? What difference does it make? It might determine whether he's still alive 30 seconds from now. Esterman frowned. I believe he's right-handed. Mikhail braked to a halt and climbed out with the Uzi Pro in his hand. Behind them, Yakov and Oded, both armed with Jericho pistols, leapt from the second car. Gabriel waited until Weber had been relieved of his weapon before joining them. Calmly, he approached the German security man and addressed him in the Berlin accent of his mother. Herr Wolf was supposed to be waiting for us. It is urgent we leave for the airport at once.
Herr Wolf asked me to show you inside.
Where is he?
Upstairs, said Weber, in the Great Hall.
Chapter 46. Obersalzberg, Bavaria. The staircase was wide and straight, and covered by a bright red carpet. Weber led the way, hands in the air. Mikhail's Uzi Pro pointed at the small of his back. Gabriel was flanked by Elie Lavon and Estermann. The German appeared decidedly uneasy.
Something bothering you, Estermann?
You'll see in a minute.
Maybe you should tell me now. I'm not crazy about surprises.
Herr Wolf usually doesn't entertain visitors in the Great Hall.
At the top of the stairs, Weber turned to the left and led them into an anteroom. He stopped outside a pair of ornate double doors.
This is as far as I'm allowed to go. Herr Wolf is waiting inside.
Who else is in there? Asked Gabriel.
Only Herr Wolf.
Gabriel leveled the Beretta at Weber's head.
You're sure about that?
Weber nodded. Gabriel aimed the Beretta toward one of the armchairs.
Have a seat. It's not permitted.
It is now.
Weber sat down. Oded lowered himself into the chair opposite, the Jericho 45 on his knee. Gabriel looked at Esserman.
What are you waiting for?
Esserman opened the double doors and led them inside. It was a cavernous space, about 60 feet by 50. One wall was given over almost entirely to a panoramic window. The other three were hung with Gobelin tapestries and what appeared to be old master paintings. There was a monumental classicist china closet, an enormous clock crowned by an eagle, and a bust of Wagner that appeared to be the work of Arno Becker, the German architect and sculptor beloved by Hitler and the Nazi elite. There were two seating areas, one near the window and another in front of the fireplace. Gabriel crossed the room and joined Jonas Wolf before the hearth. The heat of the fire was volcanic. Atop the embers lay a book. Only the leather cover remained.
I suppose burning books comes naturally to someone like you.
Wolf was silent.
You're not armed, are you, Wolf?
A pistol.
Would you get it for me, please?
Wolf reached beneath his cashmere blazer.
Slowly, cautioned Gabriel. Wolf produced the weapon. It was an old Luger. Do me a favor and toss it onto that chair over there. Wolf did as he was told. Gabriel looked at the blackened remains of the book.
Is that the Gospel of Pilate?
No, Alain. It was the Gospel.
Gabriel placed the barrel of the Beretta against the nape of Wolf's neck. Somehow, he managed not to pull the trigger.
Do you mind if I have a look at it?
Be my guest.
Would you get it for me, please?
Wolf made no movement. Gabriel twisted the barrel of the Beretta.
Don't make me ask twice.
Wolf reached for the fireplace tools.
No,
said Gabriel. Crouching, Wolf stretched a hand into the inferno. A foot to the backside was enough to send him headlong into the flames. By the time he managed to extricate himself, his mane of silver hair was a memory. Gabriel feigned indifference to his cries of pain.
What did it say, Wolf?
I never read it, he gasped. I find that difficult to believe. It was heresy.
How did you know if you didn't read it?
Gabriel walked over to one of the paintings, a reclining nude in the manner of Titian. Next to it was another nude, this one by Bordone, one of Titian's pupils. There was also a landscape by Spitzweg and Roman ruins by Panini. None of the paintings, however, was genuine. They were all 20th century copies.
Who did your work for you?
A German art restorer named Gunther Haas.
He's a hack.
He charged me a small fortune.
Did he know where these paintings hung during the war?
We never discussed it.
I doubt Gunther would have cared much. He was always a bit of a Nazi. Gabriel looked at Elie Lavon, who seemed to be locked in a staring contest with the Wagner bust. After a moment, he placed a hand on the large wooden cabinet upon which it stood.
This is where the speakers for the projection system were hidden.
He pointed toward the wall above.
And the screen was behind that tapestry. He could raise it when he wanted to show a film to his guests.
Gabriel sidestepped a long rectangular table and stood before the massive window. And this could be lowered, right, Haley?
Unfortunately, when he drew up the plans for the Berghof, he put the garage directly beneath the great room. When the wind was right, the stench of petrol was unbearable. Gabriel glanced over his shoulder at Wolf. I'm sure you didn't make the same mistake.
I have a separate garage, boasted Wolf.
Where's the button for the window?
On the wall to the right.
Gabriel flipped the switch, and the glass glided soundlessly into its pocket. Snow blew into the room. It was coming down harder now. He watched a plane rising slowly into the sky above Salzburg, then cast a discreet glance at his wristwatch.
You should probably be on your way, Alon. That Gulf Stream you borrowed from Martin Landesmann is scheduled to leave for Rome at 2:00.
Wolf conjured an arrogant smile.
It's a 40-minute drive to the airport, at least.
Actually, I was thinking about staying long enough to watch the Bundespolizei put you in handcuffs. The German far right will never recover from this, Wolf. It's over.
That's what they said about us after the war.
But now we're everywhere. The police, the intelligence and security services, the courts.
But not the Reich Chancellery, and not the Apostolic Palace. I owned that conclave.
Not anymore. Gabriel turned away from the open window and surveyed the room. It was beginning to make him feel ill. This must have taken a great deal of work.
The furnishings were the most difficult part. Everything had to be custom-made based on old photographs. The room is exactly the way it was, with the exception of that table. There was usually a vase of flowers in the center. I use it to display cherished photographs.
They were framed in silver and precisely arranged. Wolf with his beautiful wife, Wolf with his two sons, Wolf at the tiller of a sailboat, Wolf cutting the ceremonial ribbon at a new factory, Wolf kissing the ring of Bishop Hans Richter, Superior General of the Poisonous Order of St. Helena. One photograph was larger than the others, and its frame was more ornate. It was a photograph of Adolf Hitler sitting at the original table with a child, a boy of 2 or 3, balanced on his knee. The retractable window was open. Hitler looked drawn and gray. The boy looked frightened. Only the man wearing the uniform of a senior SS officer appeared pleased. Smiling, he was standing with his arms akimbo and his head thrown back with obvious delight.
I assume you recognize the Führer, said Wolf.
I recognize the SS officer, too. Gabriel contemplated Wolf for a moment. The resemblance is quite striking. Gabriel returned the photograph to the table. Another plane was clawing its way skyward above Salzburg. He checked his wristwatch. It was approaching 1:00. Time enough, he reckoned, for one last story.
Chapter 47. Obersalzberg, Bavaria. Elie Lavon recognized Wolf's father. He was Rudolf Fromm, a desk murderer from Department 4B4 of the Reich Main Security Office, the division of the SS that carried out the final solution. Fromm was an Austrian by birth and a Roman Catholic by religion, as was his wife Ingrid. They were both from Linz, the town along the Danube where Hitler was born. Wolf was their only child. His real name was Peter Wolfgang Fromm. The photograph was taken in 1945 during Hitler's last visit to the Berghof. Wolf's mother had been chatting off camera with Eva Braun when it was snapped. Exhausted, his hand trembling uncontrollably, Hitler had refused to pose for another. A month after the visit, with the Red Army closing in on Berlin, Rudolf Fromm stripped off his SS uniform and went into hiding. He managed to evade capture and in 1948, with the help of a priest from the Order of St. Helena, made his way to Rome. There, he acquired a Red Cross identification card and passage on a ship bound from Genoa to Buenos Aires. Fromm's son remained in Berlin with his mother until 1950, when she hanged herself in their squalid single-room apartment. Alone in the world, he was taken in by the same priest from the order who had helped his father. He entered the order's seminary in Bergen and studied for the priesthood. At 18, however, he was visited by Father Schiller, who told him that God had other plans for the brilliant, handsome son of a Nazi war criminal. He left the seminary with a new name and entered Heidelberg University, where he studied mathematics. Father Schiller gave him the money to buy his first company in 1964, and within a few years he was one of the richest men in Germany, the very embodiment of the country's post-war economic miracle. How much money did Father Schiller give you?
I believe it was 5 million Deutsche Marks.
Wolf hauled himself into one of the chairs next to the fire.
Or perhaps it was 10. To be honest, I can't remember. It was a long time ago.
Did he tell you where the money came from? That the order had extorted it from terrified Jews like Samuel Feldman in Vienna and Emanuela Giordano in Rome? Gabriel was silent for a moment. Now is the part when you tell me you've never heard of them.
Why bother?
I suppose some of their money was used to help men like your father escape.
Rather ironic, don't you think?
Wolf smiled.
My father handled the Feldman case personally. One member of the family slipped through his net, a daughter, I believe. Many years after the war, she told her sad story to a private Jewish investigator in Vienna. His name escapes me.
I believe it was Elie Lavon.
Yes, that's it. He tried to extort money from Bishop Richter.
Wolf laughed bitterly.
A fool's errand, if there ever was one. He got what he deserved, too.
I take it you're referring to the bomb that destroyed his office in Vienna.
Wolf nodded. Two members of his staff were killed. Both Jews, of course.
Gabriel looked at his old friend. He had never once seen him commit an act of violence. But he was certain that Elie Lavon, if handed a loaded gun, would have used it to kill Jonas Wolf. The German was inspecting the burns on his right hand.
He was quite the tenacious character, this man Lavon. The stereotypical stiff-necked Jew. He spent several years trying to track down my father. He never found him, of course. He lived quite comfortably in Bariloche. I visited him every 2 or 3 years, because our names were different. No one ever suspected we were related. He became quite devout in his old age. He was very contented.
He had no regrets.
For what?
Wolf shook his head.
My father was proud of what he did.
I suppose you were proud, too.
Very,
admitted Wolf. Gabriel felt as though a knife had been thrust into his heart. He calmed himself before speaking again. In my experience, most children of Nazi war criminals don't share the fanaticism of their fathers. Oh, they have no love for the Jews, but they don't dream of finishing the job their parents started.
You obviously need to get out more, Alon. The dream is alive and well. It's not just some empty chant at a pro-Palestinian rally any longer. You have to be blind not to see where all this is leading.
I see quite well, Wolf.
But not even the great Gabriel Alon can stop it. There isn't a country in Western Europe where it's safe to be a Jew. You've also worn out your welcome in the United States, the other Jewish homeland. The white nationalists in America oppose immigration and the dilution of their political power, but the real focus of their hatred is the Jews. Just ask the fellow who shut up that synagogue in Pennsylvania, or those fine young men who carried their torches through that college town in Virginia. Who do you think they were emulating with their haircuts and their Nazi salutes?
There's no accounting for taste.
Your Jewish sense of humor is perhaps your least endearing trait.
Right now, it's the only thing preventing me from blowing your brains out. Gabriel returned to the seating area before the fire. Almost nothing remained of the book. He took up the poker and stirred the embers.
What did it say, Wolf? Wouldn't you like to know?
Gabriel wheeled around and brought the heavy iron tool down with all his strength against Wolf's left elbow. The cracking of bone was audible. Wolf writhed in agony.
Bastard!
Come on, Wolf. You can do better than that.
I'm made of much sterner stuff than Esterman. You can beat me to a pulp with that thing, but I'll never tell you what was in that book.
What are you so afraid of?
The Roman Catholic Church cannot be wrong, and it most certainly cannot be deliberately wrong.
Because if the church was wrong, your father would have been wrong too. There would have been no religious justification for his actions. He would have been just another genocidal maniac. Gabriel allowed the poker to fall from his grasp. He was suddenly exhausted. He wanted nothing more than to leave Germany and never come back again.
he would be forced to leave without the Gospel of Pilate. But he resolved that he would not leave empty-handed. He looked down at Wolf. The German was clutching his ruined elbow. "You might find this hard to believe, but things are about to get much worse for you."
"Is there no way we can reach some sort of accommodation?"
"Only if you give me the Gospel of Pilate."
"I burned it, Alon. It's gone."
"In that case, I suppose there's no deal to be made. You might, however, want to consider doing at least one good deed before they lock you up. Think of it as a mitzvah."
"What do you have in mind?"
"It wouldn't be right for me to suggest something. It has to come from the heart, Wolf." Wolf closed his eyes in pain.
"In my study, you will find a rather fine river landscape, about 40 by 60 centimeters. It was painted by a minor Dutch old master named Jan van Rooyen."
Gabriel and Wolf both turned toward the sound of the voice. It belonged to Elie Lavon.
"How do you know that?" asked Wolf, astonished.
"A few years ago, a woman from Vienna told me a sad story."
"Are you?"
"Yes," said Lavon. "I am."
"Is she still alive?"
"I believe so."
"Then please give her the painting. Behind it, you'll find my safe. Take as much cash and gold as you can carry. The combination is..."
Gabriel supplied it for him. 87, 94, 98. Wolf glared at Esserman.
"Is there anything you didn't tell him?"
It was Gabriel who answered. "He didn't know why you chose such a peculiar combination. The only explanation is that it was your father's SS number. 879498. He must have joined in 1932, a few months before Hitler seized power."
"My father knew which way the wind was blowing."
"You must have been very proud of him."
"Perhaps you should be leaving alone."
Wolf managed a hideous smile.
"They say the storm is going to get much worse."
Gabriel removed the painting from its stretcher while Elie Lavon packed the bundles of banknotes and the gleaming gold ingots into one of Wolf's costly titanium suitcases. When the safe was cleaned out, he placed the Luger inside, along with the HK 9mm they had taken from Carl Weber.
"Too bad we can't squeeze Wolf and Esterman in there as well."
Lavon closed the door and spun the tumbler.
"What are we going to do with them?"
"I suppose we could take them to Israel."
"I'd rather walk to Israel than fly there with the likes of Jonas Wolf."
"I thought for a minute you were going to kill him."
"Me?" Lavon shook his head. "I've never been one for the rough stuff. But I did enjoy watching you hit him with that poker."
Gabriel's phone pulsed. It was Uzi Navot calling from Kingsall Boulevard.
"Are you planning to stay for dinner?"
he asked. Gabriel laughed in spite of himself. "Can this wait? We're a bit busy at the moment."
"I thought you should know that I just got a call from my new best friend, Gerhard Schmidt. The Bundespolizei are on their way to arrest Wolf. You might want to vacate the premises before they arrive."
Gabriel killed the connection. "Time to go." Lavon closed the lid of the suitcase and with Gabriel's help tipped it onto its wheels.
"It's a good thing we're flying on a private plane. This thing must weigh 70 kilos at least."
Together, they wheeled the suitcase into the next room. Esterman and Carl Weber were tending to Wolf's injuries, watched over by Michael and Oded. Yossi was inspecting one of the Gobelin tapestries. Yakov was standing in front of the open window, listening to the distant wail of sirens.
"They're definitely getting louder," he said.
"That's because they're on their way here."
Gabriel beckoned to Michael and Oded and started toward the door. Wolf called out to him from across the room.
"Who do you think it will be?"
Gabriel stopped.
"What's that, Wolf?"
"The conclave. Who's going to be the next pope?"
"They say Navarro is already ordering new furniture for the appartamento."
"Yes,"
said Wolf, smiling.
"That's what they say."
Part 3. Extra Omenes. Chapter 48. Jesuit Curia, Rome. Luigi Donati was a man of many virtues and admirable traits, but patience was not one of them. He was by nature a pacer
and a twirler of pens who did not suffer fools or even minor delays gladly. Rome tested him daily. So had life behind the walls of the Vatican, where nearly every encounter with the backbiting bureaucrats of the Curia had driven him to utter distraction. All conversations within the Apostolic Palace were coded and cautious, and laden with ambition and fear of a misstep that could doom an otherwise promising career. One seldom said what one was really thinking, and one never, never put it in writing. It was far too dangerous. The Curia did not reward boldness or creativity. Inertia was its sacred calling. But at least Donati had never been bored, and with the exception of the 6 weeks he had spent in the Gemelli Clinic recovering from a bullet wound, he'd never been powerless. At present, however, he was both. When combined with his aforementioned lack of forbearance, it was a lethal combination. His old friend Gabriel Allon was to blame. In the 3 days since he had left Rome, Donati had heard from him only once at 5:20 that morning. "I have everything you need," Gabriel had promised. Unfortunately, he neglected to tell Donati what it was he had discovered, only that it was a 12 on the Bishop Richter scale. Rather clever pun, Donati had to admit. And that there was an additional complication involving someone close to the previous pope. A complication that could not be discussed over the phone. For the subsequent 11 hours, Donati had heard not so much as a ping from his old friend. Hence he had passed a thoroughly unpleasant day behind the walls of the Jesuit Curia. The news from Germany, while shocking, at least provided a distraction. Donati watched it with a few of his colleagues on the television in the common room. The German police had prevented a truck bombing targeting Cologne Cathedral. The purported terrorists were not from the Islamic State, but a shadowy neo-Nazi organization with links to the far-right politician Axel Brunner. One member of the cell, an Austrian national, had been arrested, as had Brunner himself. At 4:30, Germany's interior minister announced that two other men implicated in the scandal had been found dead at an estate in the Obersalzberg. Both had been killed by the same handgun in what appeared to be a case of murder-suicide. The murder victim was a former German intelligence officer named Andreas Estermann. The suicide was reclusive billionaire Jonas Wolf. "Dear God," whispered Donati. Just then, his Nokia shivered with an incoming call. He tapped answer and raised the device to his ear. "Sorry," said Gabriel, "the traffic in this town is a nightmare. Have you seen the news from Germany?" "Wonderful, isn't it? Is that what you meant by tying up one or two loose ends?" "You know what they say about idle hands. Please tell me you—" "I didn't pull the trigger, if that's what you're asking." Donati sighed. "Where are you?" "Waiting for you to let me in." Gabriel stood in the entrance, framed by the doorway. The last 3 days had been unkind to his appearance. Truth be told, he looked like something the cat had dragged in. Donati led him upstairs to his rooms and chained the door. He checked the time. It was 4:39. "You mentioned something about a 12 on the Bishop Richter scale. Perhaps you can be a bit more specific?" Gabriel delivered his briefing while peering through the blinds into the street. It was swift but thorough, and only slightly redacted. It detailed the order's plan to erase Islam from Western Europe, the circumstances surrounding the murder of His Holiness Pope Paul VII, and the macabre room in which Jonas Wolf, the son of a Nazi war criminal, burned the last copy of the Gospel of Pilate. Central to the order's sweeping political ambitions was control of the papacy. 42 cardinal electors had accepted money in exchange for their votes at the conclave. Another 18 were secret members of the order who planned to cast their ballots for Bishop Richter's proxy supreme pontiff, Cardinal Franz von Emmerich, the Archbishop of Vienna. "And the best part is that I have it all on video." Gabriel glanced over his shoulder. "Is that specific enough for you?" "That's only 60 votes. They need 78 to secure the papacy. They're counting on momentum to carry Emmerich over the top. Do you know the names of all 42 cardinals?" "I can list them alphabetically if you like. I also know how much each was paid and where the money was deposited." Gabriel released the blind and turned. "And I'm afraid it only gets worse." He tapped the touchscreen of his phone. A moment later, it emitted the sound of two men speaking German. "He has 2 million reasons to keep his mouth shut. 2 million and one. He paused the recording. "Bishop Richter
And Jonas Wolf, I presume?
Gabriel nodded.
What are the 2 million reasons why I shouldn't tell the Conclave what I know about the Order's plot?
It's the amount of money Wolf and Richter put in your account at the Vatican Bank.
They want to make it appear as though I am as corrupt as they are?
Obviously.
And the one?
I'm still working on that. Donati's eyes flashed with anger.
And to think they wasted $2 million on such an obvious ploy.
Perhaps you can put it to good use.
Don't worry, I will.
Donati dialed Angelo Francona, Dean of the College of Cardinals. There was no answer. He checked the time. It was 4:45. I suppose you should give me the names. Azevedo of Tegucigalpa, said Gabriel. 1 million. Bank of Panama.
Next?
Valentine of Philadelphia. 1 million. Vatican Bank.
Next.
At that same moment, Cardinal Angelo Francona was standing like a sentinel near the reception desk of the Casa Santa Marta. Resting on the white marble floor at his feet was a large aluminum case filled with several dozen mobile phones, tablets, and notebook computers, all carefully labeled with the owners' names. For security reasons, the switchboard of the clerical guesthouse remained operative, but the phones, televisions, and radios had been removed from its 128 rooms and suites. Francona's telefonino was in the pocket of his cassock, silenced, but still functioning. He planned to switch it off the instant the last cardinal walked through the door. At that point, the men who would select the next Supreme Roman Pontiff would effectively be cut off from the outside world. At present, 112 of the 116 voting-eligible cardinals were safely beneath the Casa Santa Marta's roof. Several were milling about the lobby, including Navarro and Gobert, the two leading contenders to succeed Lucchese. At last check, Cardinal Carmelengo Domenico Albanese was upstairs in his suite. A migraine, or so he claimed. Francona felt a pre-conclave headache coming on as well. Only once before had he taken part in the election of a pope. It was the conclave that had shocked the Catholic world by choosing a diminutive, little-known patriarch from Venice to succeed Wojtyła the Great. Francona had been among the group of liberals who had tipped the conclave in Lucchese's favor. Regrettably, Lucchese's papacy would be remembered for the terrorist attack on the Basilica and the sexual abuse scandal that had left the church on the brink of moral and financial collapse. Therefore, the conclave that would commence the following afternoon had to be utterly above reproach. Already a cloud was hanging over it. It had been placed there by the murder of that poor Swiss guard in Florence. There was more to the story, Francona was sure of it. His task now was to preside over a scandal-free conclave, one that would produce a pontiff who could heal the church's wounds, unite its factions, and lead it into the future. He wanted it over and done with as quickly as possible. Secretly, he feared it was spinning out of control and that anything could happen. The double glass doors of the guest house opened, and Cardinal Franz von Emmerich, the doctrinaire Archbishop of Vienna, flowed into the lobby as though propelled by a private conveyor belt. The suitcase he was towing was the size of a steamer trunk. At the reception desk, he collected a room key from the nuns and then reluctantly surrendered his iPhone to Francona.
I don't suppose I was lucky enough to be assigned to one of the suites?
I'm afraid not, Cardinal Emmerich. In that case, I hope we reach a decision quickly. The Austrian made for the elevators. Alone again, Francona checked his phone and was surprised to see he had 3 missed calls. All were from the same person. There were no messages, which was not his typical style. Francona hesitated, forefinger floating above the touchscreen. It was unorthodox, but strictly speaking, it was not a violation of the rules governing the conduct of the conclave, as laid out in the Universi Dominici Gregis. Francona dithered for another precious minute before finally dialing the number and lifting the phone to his ear. A few seconds later, he closed his eyes. It was spinning out of control, he thought. Anything could happen. Anything. The conversation lasted 3 minutes and 47 seconds. Donati was selective in what he revealed. Indeed, he focused only on the immediate matter at hand, which was the plot by the reactionary Order of St. Helena to seize the papacy and drag Western Europe into the dark ages of its fascist past.
Emmerich?
Francona was incredulous. But you and Lucchese were the ones who gave him his red hat.
In retrospect, a mistake. How many cardinal electors are involved?
Donati answered.
Dear God, can you prove any of it?
12 of the cardinals asked the order to deposit the money in the Vatican Bank.
You've been snooping through the accounts, have you?
The information was given to me.
By your Israeli friend?
Angelo, please, we haven't time.
Francona sounded suddenly short of breath.
Are you all right, Eminence?
The news comes as quite a shock, that's all.
I'm sure it does. The question is, what are we going to do about it?
There was a silence. At last, Francona said, Give me the names of the cardinals. I'll discuss it with them privately.
You are a good and decent man, Cardinal Francona.
Donati paused. Too decent for something like this.
What are you suggesting?
Let me talk to the cardinals, all of them, at the same time.
The Casa Santa Marta is closed to everyone but the cardinal electors and the staff. I'm afraid you're going to make an exception. Otherwise, I'll have no choice but to seek a public forum.
The media? You wouldn't dare.
Watch me.
Donati could practically hear Francona trying to steel himself.
Give me a few minutes to think it over. I'll call you when I've made my decision.
Which is when the connection went dead, at 4:52 p.m. It was 10 minutes past 5 when Donati's phone finally rang again.
I've asked the cardinals to come to the chapel before dinner.
Be sure to mind your manners. Remember, you're not the private secretary anymore. You'll be a titular archbishop in a room full of red. They will be under no obligation to listen. In fact, I would expect a rather hostile reception.
When?
I'll meet you in the Piazza Santa Marta at 5:25.
If you are so much as a minute, wait.
What is it now, Luigi?
I no longer have a Vatican pass.
Then I suppose you'll have to find some other way of getting past the Swiss guards at the Arch of Bells.
Francona rang off without another word.
Donati opened his contacts, scrolled to the letter M, and dialed.
Answer your phone, he whispered. Answer your damn phone.
Chapter 49. Villa Giulia, Rome. Since taking control of Italy's Museo Nazionale Etrusco, Veronica Marchesi had labored tirelessly to increase the museum's flagging attendance numbers. In a city such as Rome, it was no easy task. The sweating, backpacked hordes who flocked to the Colosseo and the Fontana di Trevi rarely found their way to the Villa Giulia, the elegant 16th-century palazzo on the northern fringes of the Borghese Gardens that housed the world's finest collection of Etruscan art and artifacts, including several notable pieces from the personal collection of the director's late husband. Carlo had posthumously contributed to the museum in other ways. A small portion of his ill-gotten fortune had financed a redesign of the museum's antiquated website. He had also paid for a costly global print advertising campaign and a splashy gala attended by numerous Italian sports and entertainment celebrities. The star of the evening, however, had been Archbishop Luigi Donati, the strikingly handsome papal private secretary and subject of a recent fawning profile in Vanity Fair magazine. Veronica had greeted him that night as though he were a stranger, and had pretended not to notice the impossibly pretty young women hanging on his every word. If only they had seen the version of Luigi Donati, who had wandered into an archaeological dig in Umbria one soft afternoon in the spring of 1992. The tall, bearded man in torn jeans, worn-out sandals, and a Georgetown University sweatshirt. He wore it often, the sweatshirt, for he owned little else save for a collection of tattered paperbacks. They were piled on the bare floor next to the bed they shared in a little villa in the hills near Perugia. For a few glorious months, it was entirely hers. They forged a plan. He would leave the priesthood and become a civilian lawyer, a fighter of lost causes. They would marry, have many children. All that changed when he met Pietro Lucchesi. Heartbroken, Veronica gave herself to Carlo Marchesi, and the tragedy was complete. Carlo's fall from the dome of St. Peter's had allowed Veronica and Luigi to rekindle a small part of their relationship. Secretly, she had hoped that with Lucchesi's passing, she might reclaim the rest. She realized now it had been nothing more than a silly fantasy, one that was entirely unbecoming for a woman of her age and station in life. Fate and circumstances had conspired to keep them apart. They were doomed to dine politely each Thursday evening like characters in a Victorian novel. They would grow old, but not together. So lonely, she thought, so terribly sad and lonely. But it was the punishment she deserved for losing her heart to a priest. Luigi had sworn a vow long before he wandered into that dig in Montecuco. The other woman in his life was the Bride of Christ, the Roman Catholic Church. They had spoken only once since the night they had dinner with Gabriel Alon and his wife Chiara. The conversation had taken place that morning as Veronica was driving to work. Luigi had spoken with his usual curial opacity. Even so, his words had shocked her. Pietro Lucchesi had been murdered in the papal apartments. The reactionary order of St. Helena was behind it. They were planning to seize control of the church at the next conclave.
Were you in Florence when...
Yes, and you were right. Janssen was involved with Father Graf.
Maybe next time you'll listen.
Mea culpa. Mea maxima culpa.
I don't suppose I'll see you this evening.
I'm afraid I have plans.
Be careful, Archbishop Donati.
And you as well, Signora Marchese. As part of her campaign to drive up attendance at the museum, Veronica had extended its hours. The Museo Nazionale Etrusco was now open until 8 p.m. But at 5 o'clock on a cold and dreary Thursday in December, its exhibition rooms were as silent as tombs. The administrative and curatorial staffs had left for the night, as had Veronica's secretary. She had only Maurizio Pollini for company, Schubert's piano sonata in C minor, the sublime second movement. She and Luigi used to listen to it over and over again at the villa near Perugia. At 5:15, she packed her bag and pulled on her overcoat. She was meeting a friend for a drink on the Via Veneto, a girlfriend, the only kind of friend she had these days. Afterward, they were having dinner at an out-of-the-way osteria, the kind of place known only to Romans. They served cacio e pepe in the bowl in which it was prepared. Veronica intended to eat every delectable strand, then cleaned the inside of the bowl with a piece of crusty bread. If only Luigi were sitting at the opposite side of the table. Downstairs, she paused in front of the Euphronius crater. The museum's star attraction, it is widely regarded as one of the most beautiful pieces of art ever created. Gabriel, she remembered, had thought otherwise.
You don't care for Greek vases?
I don't believe I said that. It was no wonder Luigi liked him so much. They shared the same fatalistic sense of humor. She bade the security guards a pleasant evening and, declining their offer of an escort, went into the chill evening. Her car was parked a few meters from the entrance in her reserved space, a flashy Mercedes convertible, metallic gray. One day she would manage to convince Luigi to actually get into it. She would drive him against his will to a little villa in the hills near Perugia. They would share a bottle of wine and listen to Schubert, or perhaps Mendelssohn's Piano Trio No. 1 in D minor, the key of repressed passion. It was lying just beneath the surface, dormant but not extinct, the terrible craving. A touch of her hand was all it would take. They would be young again, the same plan 30 years delayed. Luigi would leave the priesthood, they would marry, but no children. Veronica was far too old, and she didn't want to share him with anyone. There would be a scandal, of course. Her name would be dragged through the mud. They would have no choice but to go into seclusion. A Caribbean island, perhaps. Thanks to Carlo, money was not an issue. It was unbecoming, Veronica reminded herself as she unlocked the Mercedes with the remote. Still, there was no harm in merely thinking about it. Unless, of course, she became so distracted that she failed to notice the man walking toward her car. He was in his mid-30s, with neat, blonde hair. Veronica relaxed when she saw the white square of a Roman collar beneath his chin.
Signora Marchese?
Yes, she replied automatically. He drew a gun from beneath his coat and smiled beautifully. It was no wonder Niklos Janssen had fallen for him.
What do you want? She asked.
I want you to drop your bag and your keys. Veronica hesitated, then allowed the key and the bag to fall from her hand.
Very good.
Father Graf's smile vanished.
Now, get in the car.
Chapter 50 St. Peter's Square
Colonel Alois Metzler, commandant of the Pontifical Swiss Guard, was waiting at the foot of the Egyptian obelisk when Gabriel and Donati arrived in St. Peter's Square. Having sprinted the length of the Borgo Santo Spirito, both were gasping for breath. Metzler, however, looked as though he were posing for his official portrait. He had brought along two plainclothes killers for protection. Having worked with the Swiss Guard on numerous occasions, including during a papal visit to Jerusalem, Gabriel knew that each man was carrying a 6 Sauer 226 9mm pistol. For that matter, so was Metzler. He directed his hooded gaze toward Gabriel and smiled.
"What happened, Father Alon? Did you renounce your vows?"
He posed his next question to Donati. "Do you know what happened after you and your friend pulled that stunt at the archives?" "I suspect Albanese was a bit miffed. He told me that I would be relieved of duty once the conclave was over." "The Kamelenko doesn't have the authority to dismiss the commandant of the Swiss Guard. Only the Secretary of State can do that, with the approval of the Holy Father, of course." "The Cardinal implied that he was going to be the next Secretary of State. He seemed quite confident, actually."
"And did he tell you who was going to be the next Pope as well?"
Receiving no answer, Donati pointed toward the Arch of Bells. "Please, Colonel Metzler, Colonel Francona is waiting for me."
"I'm sorry, Excellency, but I'm afraid I can't let you in."
"Why not?"